You're listening to Sports Connections with David Smale, the show that brings you a fun and intimate look into connections throughout sports. Now here's your host, David Smale.
Tracy Ringlesby is widely considered the best baseball writer in America. He broke into sports writing as the one-man sports staff of the six-day-a-week Wyoming State Tribune in Cheyenne, Wyoming on May 1st, 1968, the day after he turned 17. He worked for the United Press International and the bureaus in Cheyenne, Denver, and Kansas City. As a regional sports editor out of the Kansas City Bureau, he covered the Royals in 1976 when they made their first postseason appearance before leaving the wire service to become a full-time beat writer in 1977, covering the California Angels for the Long Beach Independent Press Telegram. And after covering the Angels from 77 to 79 and the Mariners from 80 to 82, he returned to Kansas City and covered the Royals from 83 to 85, covering the Royals' first world championship. Eventually headed to Dallas, where he spent 6 years, the first four as the beat writer of the Rangers, and the last two as the national baseball writer. He left to go to Denver in the spring of 92, closer to his home, where he covered the creation of the Rockies for the year before they actually had a team and remained the beat writer at the Rocky Mountain News. A native of Wyoming, about the only thing he enjoys more than baseball is spending time on his ranch outside Cheyenne. Tracy, welcome to the Sports Connections.
Hey, it's nice to be here. I wouldn't call it a ranch. It's 200 acres in Wyoming. It takes a lot more land than that to have a ranch, but we get along fine. Thanks.
Yeah, 200 acres around here is like Arrowhead parking lot or something like that. But that's still quite a bit. But we're glad to have you on here. It seems like your whole professional career is centered around covering baseball. Now, maybe that's not entirely true, but it's certainly the most of it. Where did the interest come from? I mean, Cheyenne, Wyoming is not exactly a baseball hotbed.
Well, you know, we used to get all the Red Sox games on radio when I was just growing up with Kurt Gowdy, because he's from Wyoming. He's from Green River originally, but he grew up in Cheyenne, where his dad worked at the railroad with my grandfather. And so you got used to doing that. You got the game of the week with Dizzy Dean and Pee Wee Reese, who made the game fun and enjoyed themselves. And so, you know, then we had a guy named Fred Leo that did TV in Denver, and we would get all the home games of the Denver Bears on the cable station. Channel 2 would be the one cable station we could get. So you're around it, you watch it. I mean, other sports, Wyoming athletics were always huge, still are always huge in my life, but other sports are interesting, but there was something about baseball. There was an appeal there. I think, you know, part of it just came from let's give credit to Kurt Gowdy, because you can see him do those things.
Now, I sent you a few questions I was going to ask, and I didn't think of this one until you just said something, and we'll get back into baseball here in a second, but you talk about the importance of Wyoming athletics. Your opinion of Josh Allen, the quarterback for the Buffalo Bills, you've got to be pretty happy and pretty proud of the fact that he's a Wyoming Cowboy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you think about his story, it's a great story for America, because this is a guy that grew up about 20 miles from Fresno, and Fresno State refused to allow him to be a walk-on and pay his own way to come and play football. So he went to junior college for a year. He wrote a letter to 100 different coaches after his year in junior college, because he projected he could go to a four-year school. One coach out of 100 responded to his letter, and that was Coach Bull at the University of Wyoming. So, you know, we have a lot of pride in the fact that Coach Bull believes in having the walk-ons. He believes in developing a program, and he brought Josh in, and Josh did a lot for Wyoming, and I think Wyoming did a lot for Josh. And we're very proud of him in the state for the fact that he proved that you don't always have to be the spectacular guy, but you can become one if you're committed to doing it. And I think he's done a great job. If you watch his evolution in the 3 years he's been in the NFL, I don't know if anybody's come that quick. And a lot of people are having to eat their words now, including a few media people in Buffalo who criticize the heck out of the Bills for drafting Josh.
I think that, you know, obviously I'm in Kansas City, and we've got a halfway decent quarterback here as well. I think Josh Allen and Patrick Mahomes are going to have a rivalry that will be Manning and Brady, or, you know, pick your duo. I think that's going to go on for a long time.
Yeah, and I think that it's one of those that they're going to have a great deal of respect for each other out of it, because I think they're both that type of player.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I like about Josh. If you watch the things he's done in the community there, in Buffalo. He's a perfect fit in Buffalo. Fortunately, the Broncos passed on him and made a dumbest decision. But he's a better fit in Buffalo than anywhere else because he's not a big time guy. He's a small town guy.
Yeah.
And has a lot of pride.
Now, we'll get back to baseball now. You covered five different teams: Angels, Royals, Mariners, Rangers, and Rockies. Which beat was your favorite and why?
Well, I mean, there were things I really liked about all of the beats. I mean, the Royals, it was such a great group of guys, and I was lucky. I mean, I covered the first year of their 10-year run, and then I covered the last 3 years, including the World Championship. And you know, I was around people like Hal McRae and George Brett and Quisenberry, people who thoroughly loved the game and enjoyed being there. They made me appreciate the game. You know, and I had Dick Houser as a manager the second time, Whitey Herzog the first time.
Yeah.
Probably one of the more impactful people I've ever known in my life. His value system and his approach to how he did things were really wonderful. You know, I still remember when I went back in there with Texas and he had already been diagnosed with the cancer. And so Dean Vogelaar was their PR guy, and he came over and he said, Dick's here with his wife. They're up at Mr. K's box. He wants to know if you could come up for a couple innings.
Oh, wow.
I went up and immediately handed me this autographed baseball. He goes, you never asked me for my autograph. I go, I don't collect autographs. He goes, well, here's one for you. And the man was just dramatic in that he would spend, we had a private session every day for 20 minutes. No notebook, no recorder, no anything, just he and I. And we would talk through things that happened in a game for me to try to understand. And he probably had the ability to look ahead at what was going to happen, not in the eighth inning, but 8 weeks down the road.
Wow.
And how we had to do things. And I think, you know, that was a great experience, but I can't put that over covering the Rockies, because growing up in this part of the country, you know, I still remember they were having the Jerry McMorris talks about how they were having the big luncheon in Denver, trying to draw up support from the business community. And the governor of Wyoming showed up at the lunch. And someone said, well, how did you get here? He goes, well, I didn't have an afternoon appointment. You know, it's only an hour and 30-minute drive from Cheyenne. You know, Denver's really our regional capital. And, you know, brought the point out of what a regional team the Rockies were going to be.
Right.
And so, you know, watching this team develop, seeing it go through ups and downs, you know, I've seen bad teams. I've seen good teams everywhere I've been except Kansas City. That's been important because that was my chance to come home. You know, I made the moves before when I left UPI to go to the Long Beach paper. I felt like I had been with UPI long enough that if I stayed longer, I would be a wire service guy for life. I didn't know if I really wanted to do that. So I went to Long Beach. When I went to Seattle, I had been at a regional paper, at a suburban paper. I wanted to work at a paper in the city. When I went to Kansas City, as you know, back then, the two biggest sport events in Kansas City were the Royals and Tom Watson.
Yeah.
Somewhere down the list, the Chiefs were somewhere in there, maybe after Missouri or Kansas football. So now it was my chance to go someplace and cover baseball where it was the most important thing in town. And to go to Dallas, that was during that great newspaper war down there. I mean, we'd have 60-page sports sections on Sunday. Our small section would be 24 pages on Tuesday.
Wow.
And so we did a lot of things, and you know, each of those moves for me was a challenge to see if I could handle it. And then when the Rockies came to Colorado and Barry Forbes called and asked me if I'd come up there, well, that was easy because I was finally going to go home, and I wasn't going to be wandering anymore.
Yeah.
And so fortunately, 16 years ago, we actually moved back to Cheyenne, and I commuted to Denver for a while.
I'm going to ask you about players you've covered, and I'm going to do three different categories for you. And then I'll go back and ask each one. Who is the best player you ever covered on a regular basis? Who was the easiest player you ever covered? And talk about accessibility, willing to give you quotes. You know, you were here in the World Series in 14 and 15 and figured out quickly that Eric Hosmer was a go-to, whether he had a good game or bad. And then who was the most difficult player? So let's start with who was the best player you ever covered on a regular basis.
George Brett.
I was hoping you would say that as a Kansas Cityan, but I wasn't sure. You covered Rod Carew. You covered quite a few. But
you asked the best player. George was the best player. George was a guy, you know, game three of the playoffs with Toronto. you know, they lose the first two games in Toronto, right?
Right.
That was he wasn't going to let them lose. You know, he homered twice, and I still remember I was working at the Kansas City Star, but I had been at United Press International a long time. I knew those people. And then there was a lead on the Associated Press story that said Steve Balboni's eighth inning single lifted the Royals to a victory. And I'm like, hold it. This is a game that George Brett homered twice in. He doubled ahead of that single and scored the run. He created it. And I love Balboni. He's a great guy. But I mean, that was George's game of I'm not losing. I'm not failing in this situation. And that was what made George so great, is that he was that way, but yet he was approachable. He was human. I used to love him watching him throw batting practice left-handed so he could look like Jim Cott. He had Jim Cott's delivery down, and he would throw batting practice left-handed. I mean, he was that great of an athlete.
Yeah.
And for a superstar, he never took himself really serious. I mean, I had two superstars that really stood out in my life. Probably the guy that meant the most to me personally would have been Don Baylor. And I was fortunate to have been around him. I was honored when Becky asked myself to join Bobby Gritch and Frank Robinson and given the eulogy at Don's funeral. Mm. I learned so many things about life from talking and dealing with Don. And I like to feel like it changed my approach to a lot of things, because he was such a first-class, first-rate human being that, now, this is a man in junior high school. His brother and sister wouldn't do it, but he integrated public schools in the state of Texas.
Wow.
That took a strong individual. He's a man that was the first Black student athlete football player at his high school in Texas, Stephen F. Austin High School, which is a big high school. He's a man who was the first African-American ever offered a scholarship by Darryl Royal, but he turned it down to play baseball. And he was an ultimate competitor, too. You could be his friend, but not if you were on the other side. He and Bobby Gritch. Bobby Gritch was a first-round pick. He was the second-round pick of the Orioles. They were roommates all the way until Don got traded to the Oakland A's the year before both of them came to the Angels as free agents. And Gritchie said, you know, I always thought we were best friends. He goes, well, we are. You're the godfather to my child. He goes, yeah, but I can still remember when you were in Oakland, you got on first base, and I knew you were going to steal, and I'm shaking my head no, and you're shaking your head yes. And the next thing I know, I'm in center field, and Don goes, well, you weren't my teammate.
Yeah.
It was that simple.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, I've been fortunate in that way with a lot of the people. You know, I've been fortunate, like Clint Hurdle. I've watched Clint Hurdle from when he was 18, grow up, deal with situations, change his life drastically. And then he managed the Rockies when I was here. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I it's hard for me to like just sit down in detail. I mean, I would say my closest day in and day out friend I ever had in baseball is Jerry Nairn.
Okay.
Who's the man that caught the first game for the Yankees after Thurman Munson died. But I also consider like if I needed some, if I have something, or if I want to talk about something, that Nolan Ryan and George Brett are two guys I could call at any time and feel very comfortable talking to and having them talk to me. You know, I consider them to be very, very close, not because of who they were, but because of who they are.
Right. Right.
I was around superstars that you don't really care if you're around them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You've kind of answered the second question, but before I ask you the third part of that, I want to go back to George Brett. You, like I, were at the Pine Tar game in New York. And I think it's kind of funny that George's reaction, maybe not right away, but many years later, says, at least I'm no longer known for the guy who had hemorrhoids in the World Series. So what was your, I mean, I was in the stands. We lived in New York at the time. I was in the stands for that game. Just what was the reaction in the press box when the Pine Tar game went down?
It was a story. I mean, it was, you know, we didn't know any better. We thought that, you know, he got caught for having pine tar too high on the bat. You know, we didn't realize all the ramifications of it. I mean, because I'd been covering baseball since 76. I'd never seen anything
of
that magnitude, but you know, the thing is, I didn't know what to think of it, to be honest with you.
Were the other media members like puzzled on what was going to happen? What, you know, what was the thought when McClellan called him out and the stadium started to shake? What was the reaction in the press box with that?
I think it was a little bit of a shock, I would say. But, you know, I don't know that anything got overblown out of it. I mean, I don't think anything blew up there about it, because I don't think anybody really fully understood what was going on. And as it turned out, McClellan, who is probably one of the best umpires I've ever watched, was wrong.
Yeah.
You know, so it was one where I guess even the people on the field weren't sure what was going to happen, but Billy was able to at least get it called for that brief period. I always think the funny part of it was George wasn't even at the completion of the game.
Right.
Was waiting in a restaurant at the airport for everybody to come back with Larry D'Amici, who was the TWA rep of the, which is how the Royals flew.
All right. And then the last part of that, who was the most difficult player? And I don't mean for you to throw anybody under the bus, but who was the most difficult player that you've had to cover on a regular basis?
I don't know if I can say anybody was most difficult. I don't know that I can say people didn't, you know, they were cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certain people you felt real comfortable migrating to back when you could get in the clubhouse before the game and you could get to know, you really had a chance to get to know people.
Right.
But I can't say there was anybody I ever covered that I thought I'd never like to see that human being again. You know, the only guy that I ever fully had problems with, and I got along great with his dad because I covered his dad. But it was just his personality, and he's still the best hitter I've ever seen was Barry Bonds. You know, I mean, I can still remember to him. I can remember going up to him and saying, you know, I'm Tracy Ringlesby, and, you know, I covered your dad. And Dennis Gilbert recommended that I come up and talk to you. And he goes, F you, F my dad, F Dennis Gilbert, I ain't talking to anybody, and walked off. And it's like, okay. But you know what? That was his feelings. That's how he felt. And I respected that, but I still think it's a shame he's not in the Hall of Fame. I think it's a joke he's not in the Hall of Fame. Just like I think Joe Quimmons isn't in the Hall of Fame. They were the best players of their era. And, you know, we're putting other people in that we know did steroids, but we're going to keep the two best players out because there's suspicions of what they did or didn't do.
Yeah.
I have a problem with that. And you know what? That was part of that era. They weren't against the rules in baseball at that time.
Right.
You know, I have a bigger problem with the people now. Once the commissioner's office stood up and decided to make it against the rules, okay, now it's against the rules. But, you know, when I look at the Hall of Fame, but I love Gaylord. I covered Gaylord in Seattle. I covered him in Texas. I mean, in Colorado. Or, let me get this right. Kansas City.
Right.
So, I mean, I was around him. You know, he's in the Hall of Fame. He threw a spitter. Whitey Ford's in the Hall of Fame. He threw a spitter. You know what? Those were against the rules. Those were like written rules that were violated that they got away with. So don't all of a sudden, because baseball wanted to turn its head and allow things to happen. You know, steroids, are they good? I think they're horrible. But I also thought greenies were bad. But you know what? Plenty of players that are in the Hall of Fame survived on greenies. That was, at that time, that was the steroid of that era.
Yeah.
And I think just because science makes advances, that I think we get a little carried away and suddenly trying to right the mistakes of all time.
And I agree with you on that. As you know, through my uncles, I'm friends with Roger Clemens and. Even after the time he is that both he and Bonds allegedly took steroids, and we can probably drop the allegedly, but for the sake of discussion, allegedly took steroids, even without their statistics after that, they still belong in the Hall of Fame. They were the best of their generation.
Yeah. And like I said, there's a lot of people in their generation that are going into the Hall of Fame. If you tell me that somebody didn't look for ways for competitive edges, I remember there was a guy down in Newport Beach, California, that several Angels would always order their bats unfinished because he could coat them so that they looked like they were the normal coating, but it was in Super Bowl. It was melted Super Bowl that they would put on the bats to coat the bats. It was part of the, you know, it's like anything in life. It's, you know, what can I get away with? What can I get away with? Right.
Yeah. The old NASCAR thing. If you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. So
exactly.
Why did baseball, or let me rephrase that. Why was baseball the national pastime, and when did it change, and why?
Well, I think marketing and stuff. I mean, it's, I think the one thing about baseball is that in everything about baseball, it's first of all, there's so many more games, right? It's in a society that's in a hurry to get things done. It's great to be able to block Sunday afternoon to watch a football game. Baseball has so many more games. And I think that baseball still has a huge following, but it's more on a local basis.
Yeah.
I mean, I could care less when the New York Yankees are on the national game of the week. You know, that doesn't they don't interest me at all. But, you know, I enjoy watching teams that I covered and our teams where I know people, that I like the people. But I think, you know, you still look at the local basis day in and day out. They put a lot of people in ballparks on a regular basis. Yeah. So is it the national pastime? I don't know. I don't know who makes that decision. I think it had that reputation at one point because it was really the only major athletic sport that had national recognition. So it was a pastime. I don't know that I can say football's a national pastime. I mean, there are more people playing baseball on a professional level than any other sport, because let's go down to the minor leagues and let's go down to the independent leagues that are there. That's people trying to make a living playing the sport. So it may not have the TV ratings, but I still think from a fan standpoint, it's pretty strong. I mean, be a fan of baseball, you got 162 games, not 16.
Right. No, exactly. Exactly. Now, you personally, you have covered a number of World Series. How many have you covered?
I believe the first one I would have covered would have been in 1976. And 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I just said, you know, my last 2 years at MLB.com, we had so many people going. I said, you know, if you want to send a young guy instead of me, go ahead. I don't need to. It had become one of those mass things. It's like, I don't need to travel. I don't need to stay up all night so that I can sit in a press box and listen to an interview.
Yeah.
I mean, what I like about baseball, what I thoroughly enjoyed about covering baseball, was the relationships that you made with people along the way, the people you got to know, and the fact that, you know, when I was covering the Angels and Fregosi became manager, we'd leave the hotel at 11 each day. We'd stop at the deli and pick up sandwiches for the clubhouse people, and then we'd go play bridge until the team bus showed up. And you got to know people. You got to talk to them in a way that went past where we are today. In fact, I had a player the other – last year, I said something about you. I asked him some questions, and then we started chatting. I said, well, I'm getting way off target. He goes, no, that's why I like you to come over here. We actually have a conversation, not just five quick questions.
Yeah, and that leads to my next question, and really you've almost answered it. What's your favorite part of the game? Is it the strategy? Is it the dramatic walk-off hit? Is it, you know, athletic performance like, you know, Kerry Wood throwing 20 strikeouts in a game, or is it the getting to know the people and knowing that even though, you know, these guys can hit a projectile coming at them at 90 plus miles per hour and send it back the other way, that they're just people? What's your favorite part?
I think that's the favorite part, because that's the part you deal with. When I was covering on a regular basis, when the clubhouses were open, that's the part you dealt with more often than not. You got to know the individuals involved. They got to know you. You weren't just coming in as a hit or miss guy. And I can still remember when I was at MLB.com, I went to Seattle to do a story. And, you know, it's late August and there's like things are a little dead and Texas was in plane. So I went up after the game to talk to Ian Desmond. And I said, I wanted to talk to you about making that move to the outfield. He looked at me and he goes, that's a spring training story. I said, so if I come next spring, he said, no, last spring training story. I'm an out. So I walked away and I said, okay, I understand. And I left. So now he signs as a free agent with the Rockies in the offseason, and I'm back covering the Rockies, and he sees me in spring training. And I walked up and I said, I just want to make sure on what's a spring training story. And he goes, you know, I need to apologize to you. I go, no, you don't. You're exactly right in what you said. I fully understand it. There's no need for an apology. I think we've developed a pretty good relationship since then. I mean, he was right. It was a spring training story. I was just like, desperate to find something to write about. And so, you know, as I've gotten to know him, I mean, he's very much more than a baseball person. As this year when he spent his time, he took the thing away from baseball. His wife was going to have their fifth child, and he just didn't want to get caught up in something. And he spent his summer really trying to create opportunities for the African American community in Sarasota and to build a program that's about to be released, where they're really working on trying to create opportunities in areas to have quality fields, not just a baseball field, but right, a field where there's an excitement on the field.
You know, you talk about talking with the guys in the clubhouse. And one of the things that, you know, those of us who have been in those clubhouses know, guy could be the nicest guy in the world, but if you catch him on the wrong day, you're not going to get a great response. The example I'm thinking of is after the Royals swept the Angels in the division series in 2014. I was working with AP, and so my duty was to go get some quotes in the Angels locker room. And I walked up to Albert Pujols, and I was one of 30 standing around him. And I finally got close enough. I asked a question. I said, you guys hit like 120 or whatever it was in this series, a 3-game series. You guys had the best offense in baseball. Did something go wrong with your offense, or was it just the Royals pitching? And he said, well, I don't understand what you're saying. So I rephrased the question. I asked the same thing. Was it the Royals pitching, or was it you guys? And he said, I don't like that question. And he just snapped at me. And I've interviewed him before, and he's a great guy. And so finally, the third time, I think somebody else even jumped in, asked the same type of question, and he was just very, very short. So I went over, and Mike Trout had already finished his interview, but I hadn't been a part of that. And so I said, can I ask you a question? He goes, sure. And I asked him the exact same question. He goes, yeah, that's a great question. He looks at my name tag, and he goes, that's a great question, David. You know, I really think it's a combination of both. The Royals pitching took us out of our game, but then we didn't adjust properly. And I mean, and I've had other opportunities to interview Mike Trout. They're two really nice guys. But one of the things of being a sports writer, I want to ask you about, when I was asking about difficult players, difficult situations, is sometimes you have to realize these guys are performing live on a stage, and their successes and their failures are magnified. Just talk about dealing with players with raw emotions.
Well, and I think, I mean, that comes down to, like you said, I mean, it comes down to a fact that Albert Pujols put a lot of pressure on himself to deliver, and he didn't. And so at that point in time, he's upset enough with himself.
Right.
And I think, I think he did it right too. I mean, you asked it again, he didn't get it. Instead of just harassing him over it, you know, you have to accept the fact that there's a certain amount of a pride. And when you fail at what you consider yourself to be successful in, that you have to be willing to accept it. You know, I had a similar situation in 1980. They thought there was going to be a player strike. And we're in Texas flying home that night. And the writers are going around talking to people about the potential of a strike, And Don Baylor and Bobby Grich are basically the leaders on the team, and they're downplaying. They say, you know what? Strike hasn't been called yet. It's supposed to be called in the middle of the night. Strike hasn't been called yet. Let's just see what happens. Meanwhile, Rod Carew went off on a tantrum and just blasted everybody over they were going to go on strike, and this is why they were going to go. And it was very, very attacking on ownership or whatever. So we go up and we ride it. Well, on the flight home, PA comes on to announce that the disagreement's been settled and there will be no strike. Well, in the papers the next day, it's pretty apparent that Rod Carew was mad at everybody.
Yeah.
And so walk in the clubhouse, and Don Baylor standing by the thing as the agitator he is, and says, Hey, look at this. Tracy's got a story. Hey, Rod, you said these things about people. So Carew comes over and he challenges me and he says, come on, let's go in the bat room. And I think, well, I guess I better go, because if I don't go, I'll never live it down. And if he beats me up, that's okay. It won't be the first time I got beat up. And we went in and he goes, I apologize for the way I acted. We had a very good conversation at that point in time. But, you know, it's similar to what you said, where Rod would have been smarter to take the Pujols approach.
Yeah.
He said, there's really nothing I can say. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
But his emotions got caught up with him at that time. I don't blame him. You know, I see him to this day when I go back to Cooperstown for things, and he's fine. I never had another problem with him other than that one time.
Yeah.
But it happens. People
get
out of character because there's an emotional part to them, and they're human beings. And if you, I mean, have you ever lost your temper?
Oh, never.
So it's, you know, they're human beings. They're on stage and they're paid for a very high level of performance. So I think at times when they fail, you have to understand that they may not be, it's not that they're mad at you,
right,
but they're dealing with a frustration with themselves of having not done something right. Just like I've done when I've screwed up a story, you know, or we all do in whatever line of work. You know, when I was when I was an intern at a taxidermist, cut poking the heck out of my fingers when I was trying to sew up the eyelids on a deer or something, you know, and you get frustrated because you'd ruin somebody's thing that they sent in. I mean, it happens at every level in life.
Yeah.
And it's just that they're magnified because they're exposed to the nation. We're not.
Yeah. I want to ask you one last baseball question. With all the World Series, well, not even limited to World Series, do you have a favorite baseball moment? And I know we talked about the individuals, the people are the best part of your job. But do you have a favorite baseball moment that you were part of, that you were there and say, boy, I can remember? Mine is the Pine Tar game. That's my number one thing, because I was sitting there with my wife on her birthday. She was pregnant with our son. And I still to this day get to say I was at the Pine Tar game. Do you have a favorite baseball moment?
Well, it wasn't any of Nolan Ryan's no-hitters, because even though I covered him with the Angels and the Rangers, I never saw him throw a no-hitter.
Really?
No. So I can't – schedules are weird things. Anyhow, I can't say that. I would honestly say, being from the Rocky Mountain region, the opening game, first home game in Rockies history where they set an attendance record for Major League Baseball – this was a market where people thought it was too small, that it would never be able to have legitimate attendance, that it would never be able to succeed, and to have them set not only the single game record in that first game, but the all-time single season attendance record with an expansion team. You know, that wasn't necessarily a doing of the Rockies. That was a doing of the sports fan in the Rocky
right.
Mountain region.
Right.
And I can still remember Don Baylor saying afterwards, he said, you know, this doesn't surprise me. I said, why? He goes, because I remember when they brought me over here and we did this tour and we were in Utah at a Utah Stars game because we were having a thing there. Because it's a regional, it's a legitimately regional franchise, New
right.
Mexico, Utah, Wyoming, like Nebraska. He said, I'm sitting, Becky and I get up to go get a soda. And I hear this guy say, as we're walking up the aisle, that's our manager of our baseball team. Hmm. He said, that's when it sunk into me that this is more than a Denver, Colorado team. This is a regional team, you know. So then I ran into this guy once and I'm talking to him. So what do you do? He goes, well, I'm a farmer in Nebraska. He said, how many games do you come to? He says, I've been to every home game for 3 years.
Wow.
He said, what do you mean? He goes, oh, it's not that bad. You know, a 4-hour drive in my Cadillac to Coors Field is a lot better than 12 hours on the tractor in the field.
That's awesome. Well, obviously, your home region is very important to you. I remember when we worked together at the Star, you told me that you have a daughter named Laramie after the state capitol, and you used to joke, she ought to be thankful I didn't name her Jackson Hole. Talk about your family.
Actually, she's named after the city where this University of Wyoming is, the capital Cheyenne.
You're right.
We spread everything around the state, you know, including the insane asylum, which is in Evanston, which is on the border to Utah. We figure it belongs over there.
Okay.
But You know, it's a state. I mean, it's what, the 10th largest landmass in the United States. It's the smallest population. So there's a lot of pride. You know, there's a lot of pride in the university because it's the only university in the state.
Right.
Not the only state institution, not the only four, it's the only four-year school in the state.
Wow.
So it's something that you grow up, it's part of your life. You know, it's the people from Sheridan fight blizzards to get here, you know, for games on Saturdays. And, I think it shows up. It's like when they went to the Arizona Bowl, they set a record for beer sales at the Arizona Bowl. You know, it's they'd never had attendance quite like they had because in Wyoming people, I think it's like 12,000 people show up at the Arizona Bowl. Not a lot of schools are going to have that kind of a following.
Yeah.
So it's something you grew up with. I mean, I'm out of three of the four original families that settled in southeastern Wyoming. We figure that they had to be hiding from somebody because why else would you stop in southeastern Wyoming? The northern part of Wyoming is pretty, but our part's a little bit desolate, so it's my dad was the first non-Indian, non-Native American to be born in Pine Bluffs, Wyoming. So just a lot of history that I take pride in because it's what I grew up in. It's what I grew up around. And even when we lived in California for a while, when I was going to grade school, there were a lot of Wyoming events that we would go to where Wyoming people were, and you saw how much they cared about their state.
And just talk about your family. How many other kids besides your daughter, Laramie?
That's it. That was enough. I got Laramie, my wife, Jane, and my grandson, Scout, who's 11 now, and he wants to be a basketball player. That's all he does is dribble his basketball. And he's part of my travel partner. He's to go to football games and stuff. He's there. My father passed away. He's young, back in like 1973, but he dealt with a lot of things. He was run over by a train when he was six. And my grandfather was a station manager in Pine Bluffs, and he and his buddies were going to go down and get money to go to the circus, and they're going to jump on the train and go down. And he went to jump on and he got knocked unconscious, and all the other kids thought he was dead. So they took off, and then the next train ran over. Mm. By the time they got a train there, and then they got a train to bring him to Cheyenne to the hospital. I mean, it was at the lower ankle area, but they were going to cut it off at the knee, below the knee. But once the gangrene got above the knee, they cut it off at the base of the body. Cause once you lose the knee, you're not going to have functionality anyhow.
Yeah.
He could still ride horses. He could still ride. He could still rope. He could still play catch. He wasn't. And I can remember we lived in Los Angeles, and he would park way out there at Dodger Stadium in the far parking lot. It's like, Dad, why don't we use the handicap zone? And he said, well, that's for handicapped people. Hmm. He'd walk in with his crutch because that was more comfortable than the 50-pound wooden leg they had back then. They didn't have the artificial legs like they do today. So.
All right. And I don't know why I thought of this, but the name popped into my head with Wyoming athletics, Finis Dembo. Did you ever cover Finis Dembo, the basketball player in the early 80s?
Yeah, I was not around here at that time, but I followed him very closely. He recently came back. I was at the Dallas Morning News when he went to the University of Wyoming. Nobody in that department had any idea who he was. I mean, it was amazing that Jim Brandenburg was able, his daughter worked in Austin and called her dad and said, Dad, there's this basketball player nobody ever talks about down here. You need to come down and see this guy. And so he went down and saw Finis Dembo. And that's how he wasn't recruited in Texas or anything. It wasn't like they stole him from anybody. It kind of fell in their lap.
And I always thought that had to be the best name in all of sports. What I would give to have my name Finis Dembo. That's just top shelf for sure. So I know you're not covering baseball on a daily basis. You're still following it. You're probably still doing some writing. What keeps you busy these days besides your ranch? And I'm going to keep calling it a ranch because 200 acres is big. But what keeps you busy?
Well, I got my two websites. I have a website where basically it's baseball, but it's Colorado Rocky centric, called InsideTheSeams.com. And then I have a website called Welcome to 7220, which is the University of Wyoming, because that's the altitude at the University of Wyoming, which is the highest altitude of any Division I school in the country.
Okay. And just talk about, I mean, is that something you're writing on a regular basis, or what's the, okay. I want to send people to your website, in other words.
Okay. No, it's, yeah, insidetheseams.com. I try to keep it as up to date as possible. You know, this time of year, obviously baseball's a little different. During the season, there'll be, I'll do 5 or 6 stories a day on it. University of Wyoming, I do all the athletics. But what I do is, in a lot of situations, particularly with some of the non-revenue sports, I will just edit up the releases that come from the university and put them on, so that, you know, it's a gathering base for people. And I attribute it to the fact that from the desk of whoever the head of that department is, because you don't actually know who wrote it or not. I'm not trying to take credit for doing those things, but I mean, I would rather, even on like the basketball or the football, I would rather put the game story up that the sports information department delivers, and then try to write about something element of that game different than the basic new information people are going to get. Look for that second day angle to provide something different. But no, but as my wife said, she wishes I'd go back to work so I had more time off.
Well, Tracy, I've always enjoyed visiting with you. It was fun to catch up with you in the press box at Kauffman Stadium in 14 and 15. I remember our days together at the Star in 84. And it's always good to catch up with you. I hope life continues to treat you well, my friend.
I will. Tell Randy and Alan I said hi.
I will do so. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to Sports Connections with David Smail. Make sure to subscribe, follow, and rate the show from your favorite podcast platform. You can learn more about David Smail and his work by visiting davidsmailbooks.com. Don't forget to join us weekly for new episodes. Until next time.